And welcome back to Street Photography Magazine. I'm Bob Patterson, and our guest today is Keith Dannemiller. Keith is a documentary photographer from Akron, Ohio, very close to me, home of LeBron James, if I never mentioned that before. And but Keith now lives in Mexico City. He's been living there for quite a while. He's actually a biochemist by trade. He worked in that field for a little while, then turned to photography, and now he's in Mexico doing some really, really interesting and powerful work, which we'll talk about. He's photographed for many publications, Der Spiegel, Newsweek, Al Jazeera America, The Nation, Fusion, Financial Times, The Guardian, you name it. He's photographed for them, so he's been around the block a few times. So, Keith, welcome. Glad to have you with us today.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the invite. I'm glad to be able to talk and give a little bit to your listeners about my life here in Mexico and past life in the U.S. in Ohio. I guess I should say buenos dias a todos.
Buenos dias. ¿Cómo estás?
Bien, bien. Gracias.
That's about the extent of my Spanish. We leave the Spanish up to Ashley, our editor. She lives in okay. South America.
I'll leave it at that and just say once again, I appreciate it and looking forward to talking and wherever it goes, let's go.
That's right. Oh, I guess a uniquely Mexican word. Chela.
I had some Friday night.
Why not? Anyway, well, we're going down a rabbit hole really fast. So anyway, Keith, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? You've had a very unique journey. Born in Akron, biochemist, now living in Mexico City. So tell us how you got to that point.
Yeah, I'll try and make it short and with a little bit of detail in there so people get an idea of where I've been. Born in Akron, I actually went to high school for 1 year at St. Vincent St. Mary's and then moved to Kentucky and went to high school in Mayfield, Kentucky. Then went to university at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee, and from there moved with there I got a degree in biochemistry, moved with a group of friends to the Bay Area, lived in Berkeley for a short while, and then moved to San Francisco because I got a job at UC San Francisco doing research, biochemical research. At the same time, I had always photographed through my college years and had a camera basically from my dad. And living in San Francisco began here's a little detour in the story. The actual reason I started becoming much more interested in photography in San Francisco, there were two reasons. Basically, the street life and things that I saw in San Francisco that felt like, this would be great to photograph. But first of all, this group of people that I moved with, there was a visitor that came out from Tennessee and stayed with us for a couple of weeks and decided he wanted to go back. He didn't want to stay in the Bay Area, but he didn't have any money. But he did happen to have a Canon camera. I think it was I'm not sure the model. It might have been a T1. But anyways, he had this camera. And he decided that he needed to make some money to get back to Tennessee. And the quickest way that he could do that was to buy some pot. So he bought some pot that he was then going to turn around and make a little profit on. But he didn't have enough money to make the initial investment. So he came to us and asked for a loan. And I said, well, given that I have a job or I was starting a job, I think at that point, here's $100 and collateral is the Canon camera that you have. And he said, fine. So I gave him the $100. He did his thing. he split and went back to Tennessee without paying me the money, but I had the Canon camera. So I soon after that moved to San Francisco, had the camera, started to walk the streets, started to shoot in San Francisco, an incredible, as many people know, an incredible place for street photography. Continued to work as a investigator, a lab a researcher in a lab at UC San Francisco, and at some point decided this was not the life for me, that I wanted to do something a little bit different, but I still obviously needed to make a living. Went to San Francisco State, got enrolled in a teaching credential program, which I quickly decided was also not the path that I wanted to take. But I was enrolled in San Francisco State, so I decided I'm going to take advantage of this. And I took classes in photography, both in the art department and in the photojournalism school or department in the journalism school. And came in contact with two incredible professors in the art department, a guy by the name of Neil White, and in photojournalism, a guy by the name of Fran Ortiz, who worked for the Oakland Tribune. Anyways, they sort of encouraged me. Fran Ortiz said, look, you know, it's going to be very difficult for you to get a position, you know, at the Chronicle in San Francisco, the Tribune in Oakland, or the Examiner in San Francisco. You know, you need to build up. You need to show, you know, a lot more work. Go out and shoot things that you feel have news value and take them to film. They'll develop it and buy it if they want. Well, that's what happened. I started to go out and shoot things that I would look and either hear on the radio, see in the newspaper, word of mouth, whatever, and shoot. And they started to buy some things. So that was sort of like the kiss of death right there. It was like, you know, okay, I can actually make money doing this. And so I continued. And at that point, other factors in my life, I decided to move to Austin. Lived in Austin, where I worked supporting myself doing house reconstruction. Friends that would buy houses, I would go in and redo, you know, from sort of ground up. But at the same time, continued and started to work a little bit more regularly for some of the publications out of Austin. There was one, Third Coast, Texas Monthly, which obviously still exists. I did a lot of work for them when I was there and started to make some contacts with national publications. When I started to make contacts with national publications, I decided, you know, this is definitely the path that I wanted to continue on, you know, in my life. And I also started living in Austin. I also started to make trips to Mexico, started to speak Spanish a little bit better. Made also trips to Honduras and Nicaragua, shot things related to the Contras, related to elections in Nicaragua, things that had a much broader and much more saleable possibility with agencies and magazines, you know, in New York or in Europe. And decided after, you know, long story short, decided after a while, not after a while, after actually 10 or 11 years of living in Austin, and at the end making these contacts, you know, outside of Austin in a more international sphere, that, you know, if I really wanted to continue this and I wanted to sort of immerse myself in Mexican or Latin American culture and life, I needed to live somewhere. And so I decided on Mexico City, basically because at that time, this was 86. All of the newspapers and basically all of the magazines had their correspondence office in Mexico City. People that covered from basically the Rio Grande on down, some as far as, you know, Argentina, mostly Central America and Northern South America. But that this is the place where they were working out of. So I made the decision to come here in 86, and one thing led to another, contacts with the correspondence, contacts in New York. With Marcel Saba. I worked for Saba Press Photos for, I think, 10 or 11 years. And after Saba was bought by Corbis, basically decided to go freelance once again. And that's that's the story. that's sort of where I am today as a freelance, I guess, photojournalist with a also concentration, I would say, today much more on Mexico and Mexico City and the possibilities that street photography lends to one living in Mexico City, a city the size of this size. So there it is in a nutshell.
So are you there to stay?
I'm here to stay. There's no question about it. I have a wife. I have a son. We're, you know, happily ensconced in Mexico City. People hear a lot of stuff about Mexico City about, you know, it's, you know, uninhabitable. It's, the contamination problems. You sort of have to, if you live here as a foreigner, you sort of have to make your peace with Mexico City. You can go, it can drive you crazy if you're not, you know, aware of how to get around, where to go, where not to go, how to deal with, you know, this process or this, you know, business that you have to take care of. You can do harm to yourself if you don't know. But it's like any big city. In any big city, you have to sort of come to a realization that this is where you want to live. This is where you want to be. You have to take advantage of the wonderful things that the city has to offer and know how to deal with the stuff that's a little bit more difficult.
You know, I guess it's like everything else. I mean, everything's a trade-off, right?
Sure. You know, like people say, you know, you choose your poison. And, you know, there are things about Mexico City that, yes, if it were possible to change, I would change. But here I am.
I mean, how big is Mexico City now? It's like, what, 30 million people?
Well, what's considered the conurban area, yes, is probably about 22. The actual city itself, the geophysical area that's considered Mexico City is about 12 million. And, you know, I've also heard numbers of like 10, so 10 million, give or take a couple of million.
So, is that all? Yeah.
Yeah, really.
1 million, 2 million. Pretty soon you're talking about a lot of people.
Yeah, an awful lot, yes.
Well, one thing that intrigued me is that you do workshops and street photo tours in Mexico City. I think it's such a big, busy, crazy city. I think you would almost have to have somebody with you to really go to the right places.
That's the idea. The genesis was that people that I knew had come to me and said, you know, we want to come to Mexico City and shoot and, you know, walk around, but we really don't know the place and we don't know where we can go and we need some help. And I said, fine, you know, I'm more than willing to do that. And it's in the nascent stages right now, but it's, you know, growing little by little and people, you know, getting in touch and wanting to. That's sort of the idea too, that I pitch it as, you know, there's probably 100 different tours that you can sign up for in Mexico City. And a lot of them, you know, it's the get on the bus, get off the bus, that kind of thing. That's not what I'm pitching. Obviously, what I'm trying to say to people is that if you have some kind of photographic experience, if you want to learn a little bit more, basically what we're doing is sort of like walking workshops as we walk along, and I take you to some of the interesting places that, you know, you're not probably going to see on a regular tour. You know, we'll also be able to photograph, and I can give you some instruction along the way. So that's the idea. And given the state of photojournalism also today, that was sort of the second impetus to look, you know, for other sources of income. So those two things went together to make for the work that I'm doing in those work sort of, you know, small walking workshops, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I don't know if you know of Valerie Jardin. She lives in Minnesota. She's from France, and she leads workshops. Does a couple a year in France,
uh-huh.
And then she's branched out and does them lots of places, Australia, New York, Chicago, places like that. And but I think Mexico City would be a perfect place to do that. I haven't heard of anybody else leading photo tours there. And it, you know, I've only been there once, and that was in the airport, and that was difficult enough.
Yes.
So I can imagine being in the city would be
perfect. that's too is the idea, you know, sort of that I have been here for 30 years, and I've walked, you know, most of these streets in the downtown area, the Centro Histórico, as it's referred to, you know, for 30 years. And basically since I got here, when I first got here, I made contact with a Mexican photo agency, and a lot of the stuff that I did was, you know, photojournalistically driven, but it was down in the Centro, in the downtown area where a lot of the government buildings are, a lot of the plazas where people would protest, a lot of the streets that people would march on, all that kind of stuff. So I made contact with them, and they sort of showed me the ropes. And I learned from the very beginning, you know, starting to photograph in those kind of situations. But then also, you know, going back on my own and just doing, you know, street life and street photography in those same areas that now I knew a little bit better. And after 30 years, it's not, you know, it's not like the back of my hand, but it's pretty close. So I enjoy it. I enjoy, you know, meeting people that are here, that come down, that have obviously made a decision, you know, to come to Mexico City and have come with, you know, a camera and want to learn something about the possibilities, the photographic possibilities here. So,
yeah, that's really cool. I've got to come down there and walk with you. I think that would be wonderful.
Anytime you want. Anytime you want.
So what makes for a good photo walk? And I'm asking you this on purpose because I'm leading one next week.
Uh-huh.
And since you do it all the time, tell us, what are the elements of a good photo walk?
The first thing I would say is, and this, you know, I don't want this to sound negative, but I think it's very important that people understand, you know, I don't think street photography per se can be taught. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of things that I can show you. I think there's a lot of things that I can talk to you about. There's a lot of things that I can help you with on a walk. But street photography, teaching street photography, to me, is almost like trying to teach somebody how to fall in love. It's like if you have the desire, if you are in the right place, if you have some kind of idea of what you're doing, you can shoot on the streets and you can probably make a good photograph. To me, there's sort of three elements that do operate. Having said that I can't teach someone necessarily street photography, but I can teach you things that go around street photography and help your street photography. To me, there's sort of three elements that are extremely important. Number one, walking. You have to have a good pair of shoes. You have to want to walk. You can't get tired, you know, after 45 minutes or an hour. You have to sort of dog it and keep on going and, you know, keep on looking. Number two is watching. You have to keep your eyes open. You have to keep, you know, aware of what's going on around you, and especially in a city like Mexico City. It's, you know, it's very important to know what's going on around you. And number three is waiting. A lot of my time, you know, shooting on the street in Mexico City, and people, some people, not everybody, but some people that come down don't necessarily like this element of it, but the waiting thing. You know, I will a lot of times go to a street corner or an area, a little park or something like that, where there's some kind of activity going on, and I feel, you know, sixth sense or light or whatever, something happening, and I'll wait, you know, and it may be 5 minutes, it may be 10 minutes. I may stand there for 15 minutes, you know, if I'm convinced that there's going to be at some point a confluence of nice light, characters, movement, all those things. If I feel like that's going to come together, I'll wait. So I think there's things that I can show people, and you can teach, you know, people to be aware of on a street walk. But as far as, like, you know, saying, well, here are, you know, the first five rules that you need to follow to be a good street photographer, I don't believe in that. Let's put it that way. What other elements in a street walk are important? I think, you know, for, I don't know what, it depends on what the group is like or what the people are like, you know, but I think not to exclude anything. I mean, obviously my focus is on people and how people, you know, sort of be and belong in an urban environment here in Mexico City. That's my focus. That doesn't mean that, you know, I exclude everything else for the people that are with me. I try and show, you know, hey, look at this doorway, you know, look at this fountain, look at this, you know, what's going on. Let's go up in this building. Let's shoot, you know, from up above. Take, you know, get down on the ground, look at the shadows, things like that, that, you know, I try and include when I'm walking along and not necessarily make it, you know, this is what I shoot and this is the best way to do it.
Yeah. From looking at the photos on your site, it looks like you work up pretty close.
I try to. I have a Leica and I shoot with Leicas in film. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, you know, permits me to get close. And, you know, I think, that also to me is part of that, you know, waiting thing. If I'm sort of immersed in a group of people, or I'm immersed I'm present in an area where there's people moving around, it usually feels better to me photographically to be close to that. And that's why I do that. It's almost, you know, when I go out, to the centro to photograph and to walk around, it's almost like, you know, I was raised Catholic, so I was an altar boy, so I realized, and I did the thing. I was always in the back with the priest, and the whole process of girding, the priest puts on I don't know what they're called, a white robe, and then he puts on the chasuble, and he has to put on a rope around, you know, to hold on all the everything together and all that. It's sort of like that when I put on the Leica. I sort of take, you know, 5 minutes at the beginning, and I make sure the Leica is wrapped, the strap is girded well around my wrist. In an urban environment in Mexico City, one of the MOs for people to rob you is to, you know, come up quickly and sort of swipe. Mm-hmm. And if you have an iPhone, if you have a camera that you've only got in your hand and you don't have it wrapped or you don't have it secured some way to your body, you're prime, you know, you're a prime possibility for somebody to grab it. So I do that, and I take, you know, maybe 5 minutes just to sort of, you know, clear my mind and get the camera ready and say, okay, you know, this is, we're here, let's go, you know, let's do it. But that process of sort of wrapping the camera is always sort of an elemental, almost like a ritual that I do before I actually start shooting.
Yeah, you know, that made me think about something. Speaking of rituals, one I have to get in the habit of doing, and that's setting my camera back to like its base settings. So many times I go out and it's been set for something I did that's totally inappropriate for shooting on the street, and I screw up lots of pictures because I'm not careful.
Uh-huh.
So I did that. We were downtown Cleveland when the Cavs won.
Uh-huh.
And it was insane. I can't even describe it. I still have a hard time describing it. Yeah. And I didn't have my auto ISO set up right, and I was trying to capture everybody's joy and emotion after the fact, and you know, I wasn't chimping at all, so I didn't look at my photos, and I lost a lot of them. You know, once I thought this is going to be a perfect moment, and just from being careless. Of course, I was wrapped up in the basketball game too. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, enough about me. So how do your fellow Mexico Cityites feel about the wall?
I think the first word that comes to mind that most people I talk to about politics in the States right now is, and specifically the wall, is absurd. That's pretty much what everybody, you know, when they take a look at it and, you know, just the physical, task that would be involved in building something like that, that once again, the word absurd comes up. When you look at the relationship that exists between the United States and Mexico, and to try and break that with a wall, once again, the word absurd comes up. When you look at the relationship between the United States and Mexico in terms of, like, economic agreements and treaties and the amount of product that goes back and forth, material and goods that go back and forth between the United States and Mexico daily, because there is an agreement in place to be able to do that, and to break those agreements, you know, I think once again the word absurd comes up. I think also the number of Mexicans that are in the United States, you know, whatever it is, 11 million, 12 million, and the process, once again, of deporting that quantity of people, you know, the word absurd, once again, comes up. It's just, you know, most everybody, it's not to the point of laughable. Maybe at the first it was, but now, you know, obviously people here realize, look, you know, maybe this joker has a possibility, and we have to think a little bit more seriously about it. And to the extent of, you know, government bodies, you know, Secretary of Foreign Relations, you know, the economic ministry, people, you know, on that level talking about, you know, what will we have to do if this happens? Those kind of things. But the man on the street kind of thing, I think, you know, it's the absurdity of his programs.
Yeah, interesting. I'm always fascinated how people in other countries view ours. And, you know, most Americans don't even have a passport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's a lot more now than there used to be because you need a passport to go to Canada or Mexico. But before, it was under 10%.
Right.
And so most of our fellow Americans don't really know much about the rest of the world.
Exactly.
Or care.
I think that's, you know, that is a quality here in Mexico. I think a whole lot of people know a whole lot more about the United States than vice versa. And it has to do with, obviously, the tradition of migration, but it also has to do, you know, with a lot of, you know, Americans that have come, like myself, to live in Mexico. And so, you know, there's that mix of, and not just, you know, not just from the U.S. There's a lot of Europeans that live here, especially in Mexico City. Spanish, there's a lot of people from South America. There's a large, you know, community of Argentinians that live here. So, you know, here specifically, Mexico City is very cosmopolitan, and they do know about the world. They know things outside of Mexico. That's not, you know, that's not to say 100% of the population, but I would say a larger portion than in the United States, I think.
Huh, interesting. So, I mean, I never talk about politics on here, but I just had to ask you because it's
sure,
you know,
sure.
Thing.
I never shy away from it.
That's good.
Yeah.
So go back to Mexico City. I mean, what are some of the biggest challenges for shooting in your city?
Well,
other than having your camera stolen.
Yes. You know, I've sort of that happened to me once, and I sort of, once again, when it happened, I had to sort of come to some kind of realization that this is, you know, this was still where I wanted to photograph, and this was still the place, especially the downtown, the Centro Histórico, where you have buildings, you know, from the 17th, 18th century, and you have people, you know, intermingling in front of those buildings or inside those buildings. And this was the place where I wanted to photograph because it said something to me about, you know, my place in the city. It helped me to understand, you know, by photographing there, something about not necessarily, you know, Mexicanness or the state of Mexico today, but it also had, you know, to me it had the possibility of photographing in a place that said something, you know, much more broader, much more about humanity, much more. The thing about Mexico City, and it's a positive thing to me, is that things happen on a much more human scale. There's much, much more human interaction in Mexico City than I would say in some place like Detroit. I don't know what Cleveland is like these days, or you know, maybe it's comparable to what goes on in New York or San Francisco or places in LA, but it's very like I say, you have dealings on a much more, you know, sort of street human level with people in Mexico City than I usually do or remember having in the United States. And I think there's that is to my advantage. I try and, you know, use that in my photographs to show, you know, how people are, how people be, how people belong, how people get along in Mexico City. And that takes into account too, within that explanation, you know, sort of the scale from, you know, being and belonging, which you could put on one end of the scale of, you know, socialization, the people who get along. Then there's the other end of the scale, you know, alienation, where people, you know, maybe don't quite make it in the city, don't quite, you know, fit in. I obviously stand out. I'm, you know, about 6'1" and hefty, and you know, that's probably, and I'm, you know, nice and white. And so walking down the street, no one is going to, you know, think or recognize me as being Mexican. So I stand out. And at the same time, you know, for a long time, it made me feel sometimes, you know, like everybody was looking at me. You know, like, okay, everybody's looking at this guy, and you know, you have to sort of, you know, be a little bit surreptitious about what you're doing and not throw yourself, like you said before, sort of in the middle of things and in the middle of people. At some point, I just decided, you know, to hell with this. This is not the way, you know, to take street photographs, to go out there and have some kind of fear about being, you know, in a place and with people. You have to immerse yourself in that. So what I did is it's maybe sort of a mind shift on my part, but I think it was also just a realization that, okay, look, and it was also, you know, talking to people and getting their sort of feeling about, well, what do you think about, or how do you see me when I'm like on the street photographing? And a lot of people said, you know, well, you just look like sort of a gringo tourist.
Perfect.
I said, fine. I said, right. I said, that's exactly what I want to be when I'm out there. If people see me like that, they feel no threat. That's a very important thing. They don't see me as somebody, you know, that's out there, you know, trying to capture their most intimate secrets on the street and report, you know, to some newspaper or some government agency or, you know, whatever. If they see me as a gringo tourist, man, that's, you know, I feel like I've got half the battle, you know, won right there. And that's fine with me. It's, you know, I can, if somebody does confront me, banish and explain, you know, I've worked on a book. I have a book that I published on the Centro. you know, would like to work on another one. This is for, you know, my own personal, you know, photographic work. I'm not, you know, these photographs will not be published in any newspaper or magazine at this point, you know. So that can be, I think you have to, once again, the idea of making your peace, you sort of have to make your peace with, you know, being a photographer, documenting Mexico City from street level.
Yeah, I think that's so important to, I guess, look like a tourist or look like, you know, I talk to a lot of people who want to go out with a, you know, backpack full of gear and big long lens and, you know, and try to look like a photojournalist, and all that does is draw attention to yourself.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there are people that like to shoot like that, and that's fine. If you want to, here in Mexico City, you know, the first thing I would say is, if you want to take that risk, I mean, if you have a, you know, a Canon with a 300mm lens on it and you want to walk around with it, you better be, you know, sure of where you're going and who you're with and who's behind you and have it well strapped to your body and all that. But like I say, walking around, you know, the Leica in my hand is almost, you know, invisible. I mean, there's just not, you know, it's not a visual draw point. People don't, you know, necessarily go to the camera when they look at me. They look at me first, and they may, yes, then their eyes may go down to the camera or wherever the camera happens to be. They may see it, but it's not, to me, it's... you know, and I dress, you know, not obviously not, you know, a flak jacket or anything that gives me, you know, a look of major, you know, photojournalistic activity is going on here. Mm-hmm. I try to stay away from that. So, yeah, I think, you know, you're and just on top of that, your attitude, you know, I may get close to people, but I don't necessarily shove a camera in people's faces, and I don't think that I am invasive. I don't think I, you know, I'm doing things that's, you know, that engender a response of, you know, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're not supposed to be here, or, you know, why did you take my photograph? I don't get that very often, so I feel like I'm doing something right in that sense. So, you know, attitude, I think, is extremely important. And, you know, attitude involves body language. It involves, you know, where you look and who you look at. And the idea of waiting, like I said before, too, you know, if you're on a street corner and there's other people that are on that street corner and they sort of see you standing there and they see that you have a camera, you know, it somehow, you know, levels the playing field a little bit. You know, you don't sort of, you know, after maybe 5 minutes, you don't stand out quite so much. Mm-hmm. But and you can move around and you can shoot if you want to, and probably not engender any kind of, you know, negative response.
Yeah, I guess after they've seen you for a while, you know, they stop seeing you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The classic fly on the wall.
Yeah. So let's before we wrap up here, I'd like to talk about some of your documentary work.
Uh-huh.
You have 4 portfolios, and one that really, I don't know, they're all really fascinating. One that strikes me the most is La Bestia. Did I say that right?
La Bestia.
La Bestia. Okay. Uh-huh. Migrants. I saw a... I think it was on 60 Minutes a while ago about this train. And I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about like what went into making that. I mean, it's looks like a pretty scary place to be and very dangerous just to ride on this train.
You know, I have worked, that's in the state of Chiapas,
mm-hmm.
southernmost state that borders Guatemala. And I've, you know, before this, I had done a lot of work, you know, previous work with migrants and the area on the border between Guatemala and Chiapas, Mexico, where people cross one river, the Suchiate River, and go across on inner tubes. And sometimes at times of the year when the river's low, you know, people walk across. And I've done stuff, I had done a lot of stuff in shelters, places where along the route, you know, Catholic Church usually will set up some kind of a shelter situation and let people stay for a couple of nights before they move on. So I know the area, and I knew the area when this was happening. And that work was actually for in English, it's the International Organization for Migration, based out of Geneva. And I was doing, it's an NGO, and I was doing work for them. And I was doing, it was, I think, a 5 or 6 day project. And I was down on the border at the river. We, you know, talked to people, and I shot there. And we were moving, we were going to sort of follow the trail as the migrants moved north. And we went to a place outside of, where were we? The city of Tapachula, a place a little bit north of Tapachula. And one of the women that I was working with, she was reporting, got a call that in Arriaga, where the train starts, where the bestia, the beast, starts off, it looked like it was making up, meaning the train was being formed with different, you know, cars, and that people were coming out. We were probably about 2 hours away. We arrived in Arriaga, where the migrants were now getting up on the train, La Bestia, ready to start, you know, the journey to the north through the state of Oaxaca and then the state of Veracruz and over towards Mexico City. The amazing thing about that time is when I got there, it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, and people were starting to get up on the train. And I'd seen this phenomenon before. I had, you know, photographed it before. I had watched it take place. I'd watched the cars form, everything I had seen before. The thing that I had never seen at any point in time photographing there in Arriaga, Chiapas, was the number of kids and the number of babies that were being hoisted up on the top of these rail cars, and the number of kids that to me looked like, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old that, you know, the week before were probably in Honduras, you know, playing on, you know, in the schoolyard or hanging out in front of the school or something like that. And here they were, you know, traipsing up and down, you know, these gigantic rail cars trying to find a place to sit on the top of a rail car, which obviously made out of metal, became like an oven very quickly. And I stayed, I probably photographed there, I don't know, we stayed, you know, the reporter did interviews, and I probably photographed until from like 11 until maybe 5 in the afternoon, and heard later on when we left, we were in touch with some people that there was the Guatemalan council in Arriaga was there trying to help people, and heard from him that the train didn't even leave until 11 o'clock at night. So basically, there were people that had climbed up aboard at 11 in the morning, and, you know, if you leave your spot, if you've got a spot up on top, and it's packed, and you leave your spot, you know, to go take a pee or, you know, get water or get something to eat, you don't have a spot when you come back. So there were people that, you know, that's, you know, one minor, you know, problem or challenge in getting up on the bestia. But the most amazing thing to me was the thing of the kids. And this was, you know, 2014, summer of 2014, when, you know, as everybody knows, that's when the surge of kids from Central America happened. And after that, the U.S. government put the onus on Mexico to stop people from Central America from crossing on the southern border. And so Mexico beefed up controls and vigilance on the southern border and basically shut down the bestia to the extent that, you know, now, yes, you can go down there and you can see some people getting up, but it's nowhere close to what it was back in those days.
So how long of a train ride is that for them? I mean, are they on there for days or?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, it can be weeks. I mean, really? And most people don't, like I say, with the system and sort of the availability of shelters along the route. I mean, you can imagine, you know, most people, what they'll do is ride one leg and get down and get off. And spend, you know, a day. I mean, I met people there in Chiapas that you know would get off and would work, and you know, doing just, you know, like basically I followed some guys for a couple of days that were doing ditch digging, you know, putting in sewer lines or water lines for the city of Tapachula and stuff like that. They'll get off and they'll stay for a couple of days, or if they have a little bit of money, you know, stay for a week, you know, get their strength back up, get, you know, maybe get some more resources and hop back on. So the whole process, you know, and the whole trip, depending on where you want to go, if you want to go to Laredo, if you want to go to somewhere in Texas, you know, can be 2 weeks. If you're really sort of dogging it and you're not spending a whole lot of time down off the train, if you want to go to, you know, over towards California, Mexicali and Calexico and that area, you know, it can be 3 weeks, it can be a month. I mean, there's, you know, it just depends on your resources and your strength and your the time that you, you know, have told, I guess, people that you'd be there. But it's you know, there's nothing easy about it. There's no question about it.
Wow. And, you know, this is a freight train, so I assume they have to stop and drop off freight and pick up freight. And
yes.
So everybody has to jump off while they do that and climb back on?
Probably so. And then there's the other thing of the, you know, the train goes through territory run by drug mafias.
Mm-hmm.
And the drug mafias, you know, are in collusion a lot of times with the engineers and, you know, will tell the engineers, you know, stop it at this point out in the middle of the boondocks, you know, and basically come in armed and tell people, you know, if you want to continue on this train, you know, $100.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And take everybody off and at gunpoint, you know, say, this is the fee you need to pay. And, you know, worse than that, I mean, for the women, you know, women getting raped and, it's horrendous. It's totally horrendous. And that kind of stuff definitely still does happen if you're on the beast. A lot of people have taken the alternative of either walking or taking, you know, short bus rides, from one town to the next, you know, walking around checkpoints, getting on a bus in the city, walking around another checkpoint when you leave. It's you know, it's a major strategic undertaking too. It's not, you know, it's not just, you know, well, I'll pay my ticket and I'll get a bus from Tapachula to Mexicali or something like that. It's, you know, it's much more complicated to do it.
Amazing. Amazing. What a story.
It is.
So what's been your biggest takeaway from doing things like this?
I think the biggest takeaway from the work that I've done, sort of the documentary photojournalistic work that I've done here in Mexico and other places in Latin America, is that on a personal level, there is some sense of justification for the work. There is some sense of a reward for doing this kind of work, in terms of, I feel like what I do has given voice and shown the plight of a lot of people who would not necessarily have the possibility of doing that themselves. And I have no illusions whatsoever about being a savior, and I have no illusions whatsoever about being a person who changes minds. I hope I have the possibility of opening up some minds to people that see these stories that will maybe look twice, read twice, think twice about what's going on in other parts of the world that they may not know about. And by doing that, maybe, yes, at some point, change an attitude, change a mind, change something about the situation. But I think, to me, the thing that gives me the most reward, the best feeling about what I do is that of showing the lives of people who are in situations that, through no fault of their own, maybe just through, you know, birthplace and circumstances like that, if you want to call it fate, are in a situation that I can help to say something about, and in doing that, maybe alleviate or hopefully change a little bit of attitudes of people.
So what's next for you?
What's next? I'm really concentrating quite a bit right now on the street photography work. I continue to do photojournalism, obviously, but I'm trying to concentrate a whole lot more on the street stuff. And to that extent, there's a photo festival in the city of León, Guanajuato, in September, the 1st of September, that I'm participating in with a show and also in a workshop, helping like on a street photography workshop. I have I'm preparing in the coming year for 3 shows, all of them individual shows, one in San Miguel de Allende, one in Pachuca, Hidalgo, and another one here in Mexico City. So I'm in that process of, you know, right now talking with the curator in San Miguel, which that opens, I think, February 15th, 17th. I'm not sure the exact date in San Miguel, and the other two are later on in the year. So that's the sort of the impetus for me at this point is to continue more on the street photography avenue, if you want, and move in that direction. It's pending right now, but I'm not affiliating with, but I'm doing some stuff with Fujifilm. And they're going to give me a digital, I'm not sure which model, so I won't say, but a digital camera to work with, and also possibly, I'm not sure, but I've asked for, they have like a Polaroid camera called an Insta. And I've asked for one of those too, to sort of, you know, take a major detour and do some stuff with that. But then with the digital that hopefully they'll give me, I'll be able to shoot some street stuff with that. And given that I work on the street exclusively with a Leica and film, the Fuji digital camera, they're interested in lending me one to sort of get my feedback and see what that process is like. Somebody that has worked, you know, on with a film camera, how a digital camera works and helps me photograph on the street, or, you know, presents problems, but they want that kind of a feedback from me with that camera. So that's basically, and I'm constantly doing the same kind of stuff that every other photographer and photojournalist does, trying to self-promote and get the name out there and social media and, all that. And that takes a lot of time. I mean, it's not, it's a responsibility, and it takes a good bit of time every day to make that commitment to do those kind of things.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yep.
You have to do it.
It's true.
It's the life of a freelancer, right?
That's it.
So
I've considered, I've considered opening a taco stand, but have not much of any experience in that realm of things, but,
Go back to Austin and open a food truck.
Yes. Oh, there's food trucks in Mexico City now, too.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, we're hip.
So tell me, where can people find out more about you, particularly if they plan to go to Mexico City and would like to take a workshop with you?
That would be great. First of all, the webpage is www.keithdannemiller.com, KEITHDANNEMILLER.com. Then, yes, if you want some information about the walk-alongs, the workshops, that is at www.MexicoCityPhotoTours.com. You can go in there and see the modules, as I call them, the four-hour segments, and a little description about each place that you have a possibility of walking along. You can get some idea of prices. You can make a reservation or talk to me beforehand if you'd like to about customizing. We're always open to that idea, and I have a lot of suggestions that might not be on the web page and right there that we can do things as somebody who comes to Mexico City and maybe doesn't know the city that well. We can present a lot of different possibilities.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I see. Yeah. You have excellent reviews on TripAdvisor too.
So far, everybody has enjoyed their time.
That's good. That's good. That's critical.
I'm glad. Yep.
Well,
yep.
Keith, hey, thank you very much for being with us today. It was a real pleasure speaking with you, and I hope you get back up to Ohio soon.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate your time. I enjoyed the conversation. I'm glad to get to chat in English for such an extended period of time. That's nice. I'll at some point I'll get up there, and when I do, that's usually Columbus or Akron, and if I get that close, I'll give you a buzz.
That sounds great. Well, thanks again.
You bet.